With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, host of AgNet West AgNet News Hour. Thanks for joining me this morning. More water curtailments looming for farmers across California. I'm starting off today's show with a California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News report. State officials are warning water rights holders that they should expect more curtailments during the peak irrigation season in June and July. The recent word from the State Division of Water Rights was the latest bad news for farmers and ranchers facing a third straight year of drought. California Farm Bureau Environmental Policy Analyst Justin Fredrickson says, quote, "We are seeing unprecedented levels of water cutbacks and water rights curtailments throughout the system." And now let's get into today's show with our headlines. Constance Coleman is the president and CEO of the American Feed Industry Association. She talks about advancing sustainability objectives and goals to meet global standards.
With the focus this past year of the UN Food Systems Summit and that establishing a global conversation and dialogue on sustainability, we knew that we needed to be more visible and more active in talking about what we in the feed industry are doing. So we have a couple of different ways that we're approaching that. One is we are reaching out to our members, and through our charity, the Institute for Feed Education and Research, we are working to develop tools for anyone within the feed industry, no matter where they are in their sustainability journey, can help them continue to advance that sustainability objective and goals, as well as connecting with our upstream and downstream supply chain partners. Because at the end of the day, one industry can't do it. We are a food system. We need to tackle sustainability from a system-wide perspective. So we're working together to establish mechanisms of communication up and down the supply chain, as well as metrics. Part of that, we've established, along with other feed industries around the world, the Global Feed LCA Institute, which is using FAO-developed methodologies to measure the environmental footprint of each feed ingredient.
And now let's take a listen to these back-to-back reports with AgNet West, Brian German.
USDA's May World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates Report includes some changes for cotton. Vice President of Economics and Policy Analysis for the National Cotton Council, Dr. Jody Campici, provides some context for the challenges and opportunities facing U.S. cotton.
USDA reduced the 2021 U.S. crop by 100,000 bales, with no change to exports or consumption. With shipments still running behind, U.S. exports may not reach the USDA estimate of 14.75 million bales. But the cotton is sold and will likely ship in August or September, so it shouldn't impact the balance sheet if it isn't shipped by the end of July. May is the first month that the USDA report includes monthly projections for the next crop year. USDA has estimated a 2022 U.S. crop of 16.5 million bales, which is just over 1 million bales lower than the 2021 crop. U.S. exports are estimated at 14.5 million bales, partly due to the smaller U.S. crop. U.S. ending stocks are estimated to be 2.9 million bales for the 2022 crop year, which results in a very tight U.S. balance sheet. World consumption is estimated to be 1 million bales lower in 2022, as cotton prices have reached the highest level since 2011 and the highest ever relative to polyester. USDA has projected a 500,000 bale decline in both India and China's consumption for 2022.
After two straight years of strong production, California pistachio growers could be in for another significant crop this year. President of American Pistachio Growers, Richard Matoyan, described how crop development is coming along, noting it might be another banner year for the industry.
Bloom for us is pretty much ended, so growers are able to see the number of nuts that are being set on trees. I'm hearing good reports in some areas. I'm hearing some mixed reports down in the south part of the San Joaquin Valley. Not exactly sure what that's related to. Time will tell on exactly how that pans out, but we're expecting another big crop this year with the number of new acres that are coming into production. The expectation is somewhere around 1 billion pounds again, and if that happens, that'll be the third year in a row that we're at 1 billion pounds.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the Wheat Quality Council's tour of hard red winter wheat country was underway this week. Recent rains have improved prospects for some growers. However, problems still exist. That according to the president and lead market analyst of Progressive Ag, Ray Grabansky.
A few weeks ago, we dropped our yield model dropped below 48, like 47.45. And that was as low as it went. We had some rains 2 weeks ago in winter wheat country, and that yield model improved half a bushel, back up over 48. But this past week, another decline, very limited rain, a little warmer temperatures. So we dropped about a quarter of a bushel. So it actually kind of stabilized over the last 2 or 3 weeks. If we get a 48 bushel crop, that would be what, 3 bushel below trend, that would be about 7% below trend, which is a disaster, actually. If it continues a quarter bushel decline, we probably only have 4 or 5 weeks of growing. You could lose another bushel or two. It could be as much as a 10% below trend. And at this point, I think the best we could hope for is 5% below trend. You know, a couple of, maybe a half a bushel improvement or so. But we'd have limited time left. So it's going to be a below average crop in winter wheat country.
Meanwhile, many eyes are on Ukraine, a big global producer of crops like sunflowers.
Sunflower prices have they've gone quite a bit higher. Ukraine is a big producer, number one exporter of sunflowers in the world. And so the sunflower price outlook has improved considerably. I do think that with the late planting in the northern plains, we will have a shift away from spring wheat and corn into soybeans, sunflowers, and potentially canola. So I do expect to see those acreage shift a bit. Did you notice in the Corn Belt in the last 6 or 7 days, we've had rapid planting of corn. It looked like usually if you get late planting in the beginning stages, you have acreage shifting from corn over to soybeans. And so when the last 5, 6 days, we've had rapid planting of corn in the Corn Belt. They have the capacity to plant their entire corn crop in 7 days. So it's likely they did get most of it planted. So the corn market was down 10 cents some days that soybeans were up 30. So already the market is shifted in the last 5 days. That happened, I think, 2 out of the last 5 trading days. So the market has already adjusted that thinking, the corn is going to get planted.
The situation in Ukraine is tenuous, and Grabansky says information regarding their crop production potential is also tenuous.
You have to really choose your sources for information. There's a lot of propaganda. When you get into war, the propaganda is hot and heavy. You know, reading the U.S. media propaganda the past 2 months, you would think that Ukraine had taken, you know, a state or two in Russia. Well, that's not true. Russia is taking territory in Ukraine, albeit much slower than expected. And so the conflict is causing damage to both sides, but you can't just read propaganda. You have to find some good sources. And actually, some non-Western sources would probably help you. If you read both sides of the propaganda, you can actually find the facts, probably. But you really have to read between the lines. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And each side is promoting their own version of what's happening in Ukraine. So to find reality, you kind of have to read both sides and also screen it pretty well.
With analysts looking at the war in Ukraine, weather across North America, and inflation in the general U.S. economy, he says it's a tough environment in which to make predictions. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, earlier this week, we told you that the National Milk Producers Federation and U.S. Dairy Export Council called on the U.S. government to levy retaliatory tariffs on Canada. It all stems from the fact that Ottawa made it clear they refused to meet their signed treaty obligations under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, otherwise known as USMCA. Back in January this year, a resolution panel initiated by the U.S. found that Canada's dairy tariff rate quota system violated the terms of the agreement. Canada issued a new TRQ proposal back in March where only slight changes were made. So according to the dairy groups, this week's announcement does show no indication that Canada intends to comply with its USMCA commitments. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack shared the conversation he had with his Canadian counterpart regarding the dairy tariff rate quota disputes within USMCA. Rod Bain has more on that.
I had a very frank and very specific conversation with her that we were greatly disappointed in the Canadian response.
To the recent U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement dispute settlement panel decision favoring our nation in claims of unfair dairy tariff rate quota processes by Canada. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke on the matter with Canada's Minister of Agriculture and Agri-Food during one-on-one discussions following the G7 ministers' meeting in Germany. When asked about future challenges to Canada's dairy policy, such as retaliatory tariffs as being called for by the dairy industry, the secretary replied,
"I'm hopeful that the nature of my conversation with the Canadian minister underscores the significant level of disappointment in that she's capable and the trade representative and Canada's capable of reading between the lines in terms of what's next. And maybe what's next doesn't have to happen."
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. Of course, back in April, the groups did file public comments on the matter with Global Affairs Canada. Well, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association this week condemned the Meat and Poultry Special Investigator Act of 2022. It was approved by the House Ag Committee. NCBA Vice President of Government Affairs Ethan Lane said the legislation was rushed through the legislative process without consideration of confusing bureaucratic mess it would create. The special investigator bill would create a new position in the Department of Agriculture with prosecutorial and subpoena power. The North American Meat Institute agrees. In a statement, they said USDA and the Department of Justice already have the authorities this bill would grant, making this expansion of government bureaucracy. But the National Farmers Union said the bill would increase enforcement of competition laws and boost USDA's resources to investigate abusive market practices. And Wednesday in the U.S. House Ag Committee, legislation introduced by U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson of South Dakota passed unanimously out of committee. The Butcher Block Act is a bipartisan bill that would establish a loan program at USDA's rural development for new and expanding meat processors. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
California FFA State Conference is a time for growth and discovery for students of all ages, as well as the advisors to those students. I'm Brandon Black with today's episode of Ag to the Future. Becca Duran, a new agriculture teacher for Fort Bragg Middle School, shares how this conference impacted her students in an interview we had. Here are clips from that interview. Why did you decide to take your students to the state conference?
I was a FFA nerd back in the day. I was fortunate enough to be a part of Tulare FFA's chapter, and their chapter had the resources and means to take as many kids as they wanted, basically, to state conference. And me being the type of person I am, I always loved getting involved. So I was able to go all 4 years, and I wanted that same experience for my students. When telling them about state conference, it was actually funny because my kids, especially the middle schoolers, they have hardly any idea about the FFA. They would ask me, "What do you do at this conference?" And I would tell them, honestly, guys, you just need to go to experience it. I can't even explain everything that you get to experience there. And they finally went. And when they did, they told me, we understand what you meant now.
What are some of the things your students took away from this conference?
So one of the things that I absolutely adored hearing my middle school students say is when we were coming home and I asked them the question, okay, what's one thing you guys loved about the conference? All of them had to say the sessions, getting all pumped up before session and dancing with everybody, hearing people speak. And all of them said, Mr. Ann, we want to be a state officer. But their reason why they want to be a state officer is so that they can pull me on stage and thank me one day. And I was just so sweet to hear them say, I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys. But a lot of them also took back different ideas of ag careers, because we went on some really, really neat ag industry tours. And we went to the California Rangeland Trust. We went to Harlan Ranch, which is a tomato farm. And we also went to the California Agriculture Museum. And the students said that they just learned about a lot of different type of careers, like ag law, ag communications, ranching, ag business. There was a bunch of different industry sectors that were represented in our tours. And one of our high school students actually told one of our advisors, I'd never considered a career in ag, but now I am. And so that was really neat to see.
What were some of the interactions like between your students and the students from the other chapters?
It was a pleasant surprise to see our students behave so, so well. And across the board, I haven't heard of anything too crazy happening with other schools. You know, every school has kind of some of their little bumps in the road. But overall, the students in general were just so excited to have something normal back in their lives, especially the kids who have been in ag for a few years and missed out on the last couple of years of conference. They finally got this one back. In terms of interacting with each other and with other students, our students definitely like got to know the high school students. So my middle school kids were very nervous to spend so much time with high school students from our chapter. But by the end of the trip, they all had super nice things to say about each other. Like from both ends, the high schoolers were explaining, oh my God, they're so sweet. And we're so excited for them to join high school. And then our middle school kids were, you know, kind of idolizing our high school members, saying, oh my God, they're awesome. And they're so nice. Like, I didn't know they were going to be so nice to us, you know? So seeing that interaction was really neat. And then seeing them interact with the other members that they just came across, you know, they would kind of build each other up, get each other excited during sessions. At tours, they would introduce each other, and surprisingly, you know, seeing them like give each other handshakes and just doing the whole, hey, I'm so-and-so, where are you from? That wasn't taught, that wasn't coached to them. So seeing those interactions was kind of proof. And I pointed it out to them now that they're here with me, and they get nervous, like, oh, I don't want to go talk to new people. I'm like, well, you've done it before and I've seen it. So go do it. The sessions you hear, the speakers you hear. I remember the keynote speakers from my time in state conference. And I still show, I go back on YouTube and I show those videos to my classes because I was there and it left an impact on me. And as a teacher, it makes me excited to see those impacts happening live to my students. Because they, you know, they say things to me. They say, wow, that was amazing. Like, I can't wait to do that one day. Or do you think I can do that one day? I'm like, yes, you can. And I will help you.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments. Bush Light and John Deere partnering to help farmers. Busch Light and John Deere recently announced a partnership to support farmers. Through the For the Farmers Partnership, special edition Busch Light cans will feature John Deere equipment. A portion of the proceeds will benefit Farm Rescue. It's a nonprofit that provides critical material aid to family farms. Dan Erdman of Farm Rescue says they are thankful for the promotion.
We're humbled, we're honored, and we're excited by the decision to choose Farm Rescue as the beneficiary of this kind of first time ever co-promotion here. It's not something that John Deere has done in the past, but two fantastic companies that have teamed up for this For the Farmers can promotion. Again, it's a special edition Busch Light can decked out in that John Deere green and yellow, and got the tractor on the front and the agriculture in the background.
For each case sold during its limited run from May 16th through July 3rd, Busch Light will donate $1 to Farm Rescue, up to a maximum of $100,000, with John Deere matching donation. The mission of Farm Rescue is to help family farms and ranches bridge crises so they have an opportunity to continue viable operations.
It's an age-old concept. It's neighbors helping neighbors, but we like to say our neighbors just come from a little further up the road. It's a volunteer-led organization. There's just a handful of us full-time staffers to keep the wheels turning and coordinate all the different things that we're doing. And again, it's planting, it's haying, harvest assistance, livestock feeding assistance, and then occasionally some hay hauling and commodity hauling for those farmers that are going through, again, an injury, illness, or natural disaster. And so the whole reason Farm Rescue exists is to come in and kind of provide that short-term solution and help bridge that gap left by an unexpected crisis and hopefully keep those farm families doing what they love to do long-term and hopefully for the next generation.
Again, from May 16th through July 3rd, consumers can purchase 24 30-pack cases of 12-ounce Busch Light cans with farming graphics that feature John Deere logo and equipment. And now here's Roger McGowan with today's Agricultural Law and Tax Report.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan. Risk management is a key aspect of a successful farming and ranching business. What tools are available? What risks need to be protected against? Farming and ranching is a risky business. There's economic risk, legal liability risk, marketing risk, and livestock disease risk, just to name a few. Every ag producer's toolbox should contain the necessary risk management tools. Crop insurance is the most widely known. The policies are designed to protect against a drop in crop revenue or yield due to price declines or crop losses. While crop insurance programs are largely voluntary, many lenders require borrowers to obtain some level of crop insurance protection as a condition to operating loans and lines of credit. There's also insurance for livestock, and the USDA has recently updated insurance options for livestock producers. A comprehensive farm liability policy is a must for every farming operation. Also, liability risk can be reduced by structuring the farm or ranch business in certain legal entities. Likewise, good management practices can reduce risk exposure. What's also important is to have a good ag lawyer and ag tax professional. They can do a lot to help minimize the legal and tax risk. It all goes to improving your bottom line. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McGowan.
Numbers are in for the cost the pandemic had on restaurants. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. There are now detailed numbers for consumers' food buying habits during the pandemic. USDA Economic Research Service's Food Expenditure Series shows significantly lower spending at restaurants during 2020, which was expected because of the many closures during the pandemic. The question has been, how much? The series found decreased spending at each of the 9 types of food away from home outlets that it studied. Full service restaurants, which accounted for more food away from home spending than all other outlets from 1997 to 2019, experienced a decrease in spending of 31.7% in 2020. Even restaurants that were able to stay open with drive-through or limited services saw a drop. They dropped 6.7%. Hotels and motels, recreational places, and drinking establishments also experienced closures and capacity restrictions through most of 2020. Food spending fell 42.9% at hotels and motels, 37.7% at recreational places, and 40.7% at drinking places. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Blue eyes crying in the rain.
Hello, everybody out there in farm country. The radio commentary is brought to you by the National Corn Growers Association, Crop Life America, and the Renewable Fuels Association. They are friends, supporters, and allies of a healthy farm economy in prosperous rural America. And now for today's commentary. I have five different issues to bring up today. Number one, here is something proposed by the Securities and Exchange Commission that will cost family farms and small business agriculture lots of time and money. They want to require corporations to report on greenhouse gas emissions in their supply chain. Well, farmers are part of that supply chain. The American Farm Bureau Federation is right. It would increase agriculture costs that are already going up. Number two, Putin's war in Ukraine is front page every day. Russia's military is stealing hundreds of thousands of tons of Ukrainian wheat, and they're stealing vegetable oil too. Russia and Ukraine are the biggest exporters of wheat in the world. However, Ukraine is not able to export on the Black Sea. Russia has shut that door. The countries that rely on that food supply are very concerned, as they should be. Number three, an incentive to encourage more U.S. production has been suggested. And the idea is to offer an extra $10 per acre to farmers if they double crop wheat and soybeans. Well, some farms do that now. I have done it in years past, but you can expect to experience a lower yield, especially from your soybeans. We've very good prices for wheat and soybeans now. I think most farmers will make the judgment of their farming practices that will bring in the most money. We shouldn't be trying to subsidize this farming decision. Number four, the Homeland Security has created a disinformation government board. That is scary. The government departments can be very political. They will strive to shut down any free speech that doesn't agree with them. The media is supposed to evaluate the issues and give us the facts. And I know they haven't done the job they should. But handing that job to a politically appointed government department would be complete surrender. Last subject. Here's a very sobering picture, said Jean Dobonel, who has headed the Government Accountability Office. Our federal government faces an unsustainable fiscal future. We are all aware that we keep running a big budget deficit. Our government will have to just borrow more money, and with interest rates going up, that borrowing will cause our debt to skyrocket. Think about the money we are supplying to support Ukraine now. Until next week, I am John Block from Washington.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, we have another episode of The Voices of the Valley. And this week's episode is the second part in a series with the folks at Verdant Robotics, talking about the landscape of ag tech development and how to meet the needs of farmers.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
Welcome back. This is Dennis Donahue with another episode of Voices of the Valley and Candace Wilson. And we're here for part two with our friends from Verdant Robotics, Curtis Gardner and Gabe Sibley. We had a terrific first part of the conversation and looking forward to picking up the conversation and and really talking more in depth about Verdant Robotics, what they're doing, business model, and vision for the future. So welcome back, and let's pick it up where we left off.
Because you guys are collecting so many data points with your imagery, how can that be used for, you know, I guess your product pipeline or identifying other partnerships? Is there a business model where, you know, just the data, the value of the data itself then can be extended to a different partner who may want to focus on something? Or what do those business models look like?
It's a great question. That story I was telling you about when we would ask farmers, like, hey, we could tell you every millimeter of your farm what's happening. We tell you where the leaky irrigation is, where the fire right pressure is, you know, we tell you a lot. And the answer was always, please don't give us more data. Please try to understand the data, or better yet, go do an action. So we really took that to heart. And so the value is not necessarily in the data. It's in the actions that the data enables. And the amount of data that we collect is, frankly, so vast that there's no possible way we could keep it all. You know, it's terabytes and terabytes per day. And so what we do is we mine it for the actionable information in order to train the machine to do the job. And then once the machine has the ability to do the job, a lot of times the data is gone. There's just simply too much. Now, there is going to be valuable information in there, and we'll figure out how, together with our growing partners, you know, what to pull out of it, what to go after, what insights to follow. Curtis was talking about three legs to the stool. And this is kind of our secret sauce, right? It's we index, we act, and we discover. So we build a digital twin of the farm in real time, you know, sub-centimeter geometric model, track it over time. So it's spatial, temporal, but we also classify everything we see. So it's got a semantic layer too. So we understand what we're seeing. So that's that digital twin built in real time. And we act, you know, we guide the growth by delivering the right inputs at the right time. But when you have that ability, now you can take that digital model and you can start to search and compare and correlate, and again, bring that superpower of computation to bear. That allows you to discover novel growing practices, new policies that are ultimately, we believe, way more valuable than those initial pain points that we address in the first place. So index, act, discover, and that discover leg is probably the most important part.
Sure.
Curtis, can you talk a little, you know, let's kind of get on farm a little bit. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about labor, and then Gabe, you know, your background on the autonomous vehicle side. You know, there's been this perception, you know, that all of this automation is replacing people. But the reality is, I think you're encountering, there's a shortage and there is a critical need. And that certainly has been helpful in terms of accelerating use on the farm. So kind of talk about that whole labor relationship. And then along with that, you know, Candace and I are mindful of our good friends at Reedley College who are sponsors right now. We've all been talking about, and you've been involved with, and thanks for joining us at Hartnell last week, that whole conversation about what are the skills that are going to have to go along with this? Because you're going to have to upskill workers and all that good stuff. So the reality is, from a labor standpoint, is your view the same as ours, that this is fundamentally an opportunity more than anything, because particularly on top of the labor shortage?
Yes, absolutely. It's probably the aspect that I'm most excited about. I've been excited about this aspect for, you know, kind of my entire career. When I was at Morningstar, we built machines that got too complicated and we didn't have the field staff to support them. You know, they couldn't troubleshoot and diagnose anymore. So I brought that learning here, and Gabe already had it, but the machines that we've built are modular, and it's just a red LED for change this, a green LED for everything's good. So everything's modular, everything's cheap enough that we could just replace in the field and send that bad unit back to the PhDs and let them root cause and diagnose and fix that failure point so it never fails that way again. The cost side in the field is one thing, and the growers aren't really speaking about that. They're really speaking to me about the labor availability. They just can't get the people. Just full stop, just can't get the people. And so we're coming into the market right at a time where they're experiencing an extreme dire need. And what I'm most excited about is developing the employees that we need, these new workers, these workers that kind of don't exist yet. We're going to have to skill them up and teach them and help them to understand a little bit about computers, a little bit about electronics, and, you know, going beyond just a multimeter and taking the oscilloscope out and chasing down bugs and wires and everything. I'm really excited about developing these workers. And, you know, I'm not going to leave the current ag workers behind. I was on the back of a transplanter. Like, I think nobody knows that's where I started, right? So I had a college degree in finance, and I was on the back of a transplanter transplanting tomato plants at one point in time before I started my career. So I really came from the field. And so these are people that I have great affinity for, a tremendous amount of respect for them and the work ethic they've shown. And I'm not going to leave them behind, and I'm going to bring them with us. And so, you know, we're going to take folks and give them thriving wages. The value that we create with our machine, you know, a lot of that's going to be passed to that driver, because we are going to ask that driver to be more skilled, right? He's going to have his QAL. He's going to have his commercial driver's license. He's going to be responsible for a big, very expensive piece of machinery, and that's doing a job for a customer earning millions of dollars. So he himself is going to be, you know, a multi-million dollar business unit. And so this person's going to have to be very capable. And so I'm just so excited and thrilled to be able to help folks out in this way and just provide them a new opportunity. So it's a very exciting time for me.
Yeah, no, that sounds, I've always appreciated your enthusiasm in that regard. Gabe, you know, I'm really, go ahead, Gabe.
I just want to follow up on what Curtis said there, because there's a whole other aspect to this too. We're really taking field workers and turning them into data workers as well, because there's this whole labeling ground truth data science side to it where we've got to teach the machines how to do the job. And what that looks like is saying, here's a weed and here's a carrot, and labeling data at really large scales. And that's true across every crop. So we have dozens of employees that have that same knowledge that instead of, you know, weeding with their hands, they're doing it virtually on a screen. And that act is how you're teaching the machine to understand the task in the first place. So there's this, you know, huge workforce of data workers that's created to do this job.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
We're joined again by Western Region Sales Agronomist at AgroLiquid, Abe Isaac. And now continuing our conversation of using potassium to counter some of the impacts of sodium issues in orchards. Abe, what are some other measures that growers can take to help address sodium problems?
Another factor that you can do to that is put a very soluble calcium in there with it through the soil, and that will create cation exchange. And then as you irrigate, you can leach some of that sodium out of the root zone and push it back down deep. With this drought conditions that we have, the soil keeps drying out. Well, as the water went down, it took sodium with it. What does it take back up with it when it evaporates back up through the soil and dries out? It will have a tendency to pull that sodium back up with it. So we've got to continue to keep that root zone wet and open with calcium. And there are several products that a guy can use with that. There's lots of 10% calcium, liquid calciums out there. Even calcium nitrate, when you fertilize your trees with nitrogen, switching to that. I have growers that do that. That works very well because you're amending your soil and feeding your plant at the same time, and that works very well.
And so this year, based on how dry it is and the fact that we don't have much water available, is it likely that some of these sodium issues might be a little bit more prevalent this year versus some previous years, just based on how hot and dry it is and how that reaction is going to happen maybe on a larger scale?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what's going to be an issue. And the kick in the pants On the other side of that is that as that sodium is builds in that soil, it also tightens it up. So water penetration becomes much more of a problem. And so with these dry years, you'd like to have that, try to get your moisture as deep into that soil as you can. Primarily, it's just the holding capacity of it so that it doesn't just evaporate off the surface of the ground. I've gone to many, many farms where you dig into the soil and it's wet and muddy the top 5 inches. But after that, it really gets very, very dry. By the time you get to a foot, it's just dust. And so a lot of that could be traced back to that sodium issue, making sure that you're putting that calcium in there to open that up and it'll open that soil up so that water can get better, penetrate the soil much, much better. Growers will have a tendency to look at their soil tests and say, wait a minute, my soil test says I've got lots of calcium. It does, but that doesn't mean that it's available and that it's working like it needs to. We're not talking about going out and putting tons of a product on. We're talking about putting a few pounds on to open that soil up per acre. And it really does a phenomenal job. The bang for your buck is very good on those type of applications.
Very good. And again, for more information from the folks at AgroLiquid, you can visit agroliquid.com.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.